This is the Awful Announcing Podcast.
Three-pointer.
Oh, Hutchins! Double honor!
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, wow! In your life have you seen anything like that?
Oh!
LeBron James with no regard for human life!
Welcome to the AA Podcast.
Madden, what are you still doing here?
Here's Matt Yoder.
Pleased to welcome to this week's podcast, longtime radio voice of the Boston Celtics, and maybe, just maybe, the third most famous wrestling fan in sports. Sean, I think I'll put you behind Michelle Beadle and Bill Simmons. I think you're right there, number three, the one and only Sean Grandy. Sean, welcome.
I've spent so much time behind those two who are my friends, and here's how I knew. I told Bill this, we were recounting the story the other day in L.A. when I saw him. Bill was someone who I've known for so long. He was actually writing about when he was in his parents' basement, or, you know, whatever the equivalent of that was, writing about me when I was the next big thing 15 years ago. And about 3 or 4 years ago, we're walking through Madison Square Garden, which is my home. That's my building where I grew up, and I'm walking with Bill. And all of a sudden, people are chanting, "Sports guy, it's the sports guy, sports guy." And I just have ever had a moment. Everybody wants to be Shawn Michaels and Marty Jannetty, but nobody wants to be Jannetty. And you have that horrible feeling when you realize you've become that guy.
Well, I mean, you know, Jannetty, I mean, if you look at the totality of his career, I mean, it's not all that bad. I mean, not everyone, Shawn, can be the main event, you know, A-level players. I mean, at least you're not like Barry Horowitz or someone, so it could be worse, you know?
The problem is anyone who knows Bill and knows me knows I'm much more likely to throw him through a window.
Of course, one of the famous scenes in wrestling history. Right, we'll save that good stuff for the end. First of all, let's get to the Celtics, your main job, and, you know, play-by-play radio voice for the Boston Celtics. Not a bad consolation prize if you want to call yourself the Marty Jannetty of that pairing. First, let's get to the rumors. Let's get the controversy out of the way. No truth that Brad Stevens is deflating basketballs to give the Celtics a competitive edge, right?
Hey, if it would slow down DeAndre Jordan and some of these guys, I mean, I think whatever it would take at this point. He's Brad tries everything there is to possibly try, and then in the final 5 minutes of the game, he's got his starting, you know, the other team's starting five comes back in, and, you know, the Celtics like Minnesota, like the Knicks, like Philadelphia, like the Lakers. This is how the NBA works. It's very hard to win games every night when you're outmatched.
Let's talk about this season. In the last month, Sean, these are the players that have either left Boston, came to Boston, or passed through Boston for a cup of coffee and a Dunkin' Donut. Rondo, Jay Crowder, Jameer Nelson, Dwight Powell, Brandon Wright, Jeff Green, Tayshaun Prince, Austin Rivers, Nate Robinson, Chris Douglas Roberts, and the great Shavlik Randolph. Did I miss anyone in that, or is there someone else that's hiding in there that you've had to meet in the past few weeks and try to learn their name?
Well, the nice thing is, I'm just thinking about, as you run those names in my head, the music, I'm thinking about their return to the Garden, you know, the Jumbotron videos with the 3 weeks of Brandon Wright. You know, when Jameer Nelson will come back as a member of the Nuggets, and we saw his, it'll be the second time we see a Jumbotron, you know, we saw his in Orlando. Like, we get to Orlando, and there's Jameer Nelson's Jumbotron, and then, you know, maybe we should be able to, we're at the point now, at least with most of these welcome backs, we can run them during free throws. I mean, they're going to be so short, you know, just like holding up a jersey, and then, you know, maybe standing around missing a dunk or something, and that'll be the
Austin Rivers retrospective. I mean, it should be legendary with the highlights there.
That was an amazing thing. We just saw Austin because he's staying, you know, most players when they get traded stay in a hotel for a couple of weeks, and he's staying in the hotel where we just were. So we saw more of Austin the last 3 days as a member of the Clippers than obviously we never saw him as a member of the Celtics. And I said we saw him more. He played more as a Celtic in practice and in pregame drills when he was 13, you know, playing against our team than he ever got close to playing this time.
How hard as the voice of this team is it to do your research day to day and to keep track of who's actually taking the floor when the turnstiles are moving that quickly?
It's different. You know, ask any announcer, if you've done for example, the first day of the NCAA tournament when you have eight teams to learn. If you've ever done a nationally televised college football game on ABC, for example, that's a six-day pick where you get the teams on Sunday. If you've ever had, and I've done that, but even probably the hardest thing when people ask me, the old NCAA hockey tournament, now it's regional sites and it's one game elimination and four teams go to each place. There was a period of about 10, 12 years where six teams would go to two sites. There were 12 teams in the tournament. And, you know, four teams would play the first day and the two winners would play two new teams the next day. And trying to learn six hockey teams in 3 or 4 days is harder than, you know, cutting and pasting Tayshaun Prince over Jameer Nelson on your Celtics game card. So I think the content of the games and keeping people entertained and amused, which is what we try to do in telling the story, provides more challenge than cutting and pasting.
With the trades of Rondo and Jeff Green, is it obviously the answer is probably yes, but this rebuilding mode that the Celtics are in under Brad Stevens, they haven't quite hit rock bottom like the Knicks or the Sixers. But on the other hand, those are the only teams behind Boston in the East right now. I don't think that we, you know, nationally have really paid much attention to the Celtics as a rebuilding team. So where is Danny Ainge? Where is Brad Stevens? Where is the philosophy here moving forward now that those big stars are gone?
Clearly, in Philadelphia and to a lesser degree in Minnesota, losing games is a priority. I think there's no question that Philadelphia has made an art form out of it. With teams like the Celtics, the goal is to amass assets, young players, and as many draft picks and trade exceptions as possible to put yourself in position. And it's not how many games you win or don't win. It's that becomes the priority. And whatever that leaves, whatever, you know, good luck, Brad. Whatever you can do with what's left of this operation, you know, we're going to take your best players away one by one and do it mid-season, which is, you know, especially difficult. Last year, if you notice, the Celtics had players that one by one, actually, when I say you noticed, you probably didn't notice, like most people, you know, nationally, as you said, we couldn't be off the radar. We had one national TV game this year after a six-year run of averaging about 22 a year.
Wow.
We had one national TV game this year, and it got pulled. And that was against Atlanta, good thing, because, you know, the Celtics got trampled that night. But yeah, that was literally 22. I think I tweeted that the day it happened. I looked it up. It was 22 point something was the average number during what we call, you know, the new big three era. And this year the Celtics got one and it got yanked. I see my friends now once in a long while. I'll see Mark Stein. I'll see Adrian Wojnarowski. I saw David Aldridge. I was doing the CBS game last year in D.C. I see David Aldridge after the game, and he's like, "Hey, how you doing?" And a big hug, and we're catching up. And after 5-10 minutes, you know, it's like, well, David Aldridge says, "Well, I'll see you soon." I'm like, "No, you won't. No, you won't. I'll see you at I'll see you at the meetings next year. I'll see you on TV, but no, you won't." Because there are, you know, Matt, there's two NBAs. There's the Thursday night TNT, Sunday afternoon ABC, you know, there's Mike and Jeff and Doris and Mark Jackson, and there's Charles Barkley, and there's EJ, and there's Kevin Harlan and Mark. There's that NBA, and there's the Tuesday night games between, you know, Sacramento and Charlotte. And it's very much, I've compared it for years to, you know, Premier League soccer. It's, you know, there's the relegation pool. And the Celtics were dead center in the middle of the NBA for 6 years, and this is the way it goes. And the idea is to get back there as fast as possible. So the Danny plan has less to do with winning or losing. Last year seemed to be more about that. Everyone was into that whole tanking thing last year, and thank God that went away as far as Celtics fans are concerned. But the goal is about the future and about winning and about putting yourself in position. And what happens this year, you want to develop Kelly Olynyk and Jarrett Solinger, and particularly Marcus Smart, but what happens on the floor becomes, you know, secondary is the wrong word, but 2017-2018 is more important to this franchise than this year is now.
You've been on both sides of that NBA divide as a broadcaster. Obviously, Garnett, Pierce, Allen sort of kicking off the big three era. Even before that, though, I mean, you look back at the days of Antoine Walker and Paul Pierce. That was a good Celtics team that had some dramatic playoff victories and some good runs. Now, though, in rebuild mode, how much more difficult is it the daily grind, the 82-game season, to get yourself up to call these games? I mean, I can't imagine, just personally, Sean, being frank, that, you know, saddling up to watch this team lose by 30, 40 points to a team like Atlanta is going to be a fun job necessarily. So for you as an announcer, trying to balance what's happening this season, also trying to give the fans some kind of hope and optimism to say, you know, there will be a new day coming. How do you balance those, and how different is it than calling those games in the finals a few years ago?
Well, your job is to cover those of us who are completely self-involved and self-aggrandizing and think the world revolves around us and had to be so hideously ignored as children that we had to grow up to have a job that involved a microphone so, you know, we could say, look at me, I'm talking. Please, somebody look. I don't know what happened to us as kids, what went wrong, but this is what, you know, it leads to. That said, in a moment of self-awareness, I think all of us realize that no matter you do a team that's 0-82, they'll still be twerking for a living. And the secondary part of that is there's a story to be told every night, and you're still in the NBA. And something I do, quite frankly, I do this every night. I try, before we start the show, I try to find a kid in the crowd. I try to find an 8-year-old kid, a 10-year-old kid who has the wide eyes because he's had an NBA game, because that was me. And that was most of us that do this, that weren't good enough or tall enough or whatever to play, that we realize we're fortunate. But I just believe, and this is the play-by-play guy in me, that there is a story within every game, whether you're going against Doc Rivers, the gauntlet of Marcus Smart, trial by fire, going against all of these point guards that he's going to see on this trip. We're going to see Damian Lillard on this trip. We're going to see Steph Curry on this trip, and Ty Lawson, and, you know, the learning curve there, and the Celtics trying to acclimate on the fly, Brad Stevens figuring out the NBA. So even from a Celtics standpoint, there's plenty of stories, not to mention the fact, on the one hand, yeah, Atlanta comes in and runs over us. You get to tell the story of the Atlanta Hawks and what they're doing, which is sort of a mini version of what the Celtics did in 08. They don't have the Hall of Fame star power, but they play as a team. They have star caliber players who are all playing together for a coach who's brought, you know, the Greg Popovich style with him. And that's a great story. The NBA is full of them, and you see them every night. Tomorrow night, you know, Damian Lillard is one of the most enjoyable stories. He's a two-star recruit out of high school, who had to go to a small college that nobody watched play. And here he is now, one of the elite players in the NBA. And there's, you know, Nicholas Batum is not having a great year, but how has, you know, what happened in Paris a couple of weeks ago weighed on him as he tries to play with friends and family. So, you know, obviously I can go on for hours and hours. That's what I do for a living. But I think there's a story to be told every night. And if you're assigned the games, you know, all of us have found ourselves assigned games that are not necessarily marquee games. Well, I'm doing a game for CBS or years ago. Listen, when I was doing college football at ABC years ago, every game I touched turned to dust. It was like 28-0 in the second quarter. So you better have compelling stories to tell. And there's always, you know, as I said, I used to basically, I would start these games with half the country watching, and they would take my audience away to Brent. And, you know, I had probably more people playing in the game than watching by the time they were over. So I've had plenty of practice.
You mentioned a bit ago the gathering of assets that the team is doing. And if we just flip back to Boston's strategy here, moving forward, I mean, we saw, you know, when the first big three, and really it was the first big three in this big three era the NBA has been in the past decade, you had Paul Pierce in Boston to build around. Paul Pierce isn't there right now. So is the strategy and the blueprint for this group now clearing cap room? Is it getting all those assets to trade? Is it maybe firing away at these 97 draft picks the Celtics have and hoping you get maybe 3 or 4 top guys to build around? What's the blueprint? What's the strategy right now? Do you think that it's going to be gather these assets and make maybe a few big trades? Or do you think it's going to be finding some guys that can grow into a championship contender? Maybe like we've seen in Atlanta with the Hawks getting it done without really a traditional superstar player?
I think it's all of the above. And, you know, OKC is another great example of that. To Washington, really, you know, Beal and Wall. The problem is the Celtics, keep this in mind, for everything that Danny Ainge has done here, there's one thing left that Danny hasn't really done yet, and that's get a top 5 pick. You know, he's traded, you know, he traded them when he had them. There was the Jeff Green year, the year they made the the Randy Foyt, Brandon Roy thing that Celtics were involved in. But he hasn't had, a top five pick to make a big splash with and to build around as a star. I think it's all of the above. And I think it's the old books when a lot of us were kids, and most a lot of you are too young now to remember these books, where you get to the end of the page and it would say, to do this, turn to page 24. To do this, turn to page 40. You create your own story. And that is what Danny is doing, and that he's got the ability. Obviously, he would love to land another big three through free agency and through trades. And, for example, I'm not starting rumors. This is how they get started. But you are matched up, for example.
Hypothetically speaking.
Let's say you had a team, I don't know, that was in New York. And there's no way they're going to be contending for the next 2 or 3 years. They've got a superstar on their roster who, by the time they are ready again, likely to contend, will not be in the prime years of his career, which he is now. And let's say you are much better off gathering young players and young assets. You have very few draft picks in your, in your chamber that you want to throw in there. So you're looking for a team that you could get rid of this big contract and this superstar player to add, young players and add draft picks and draft assets like that and, and first round picks. That's an example of what you can do if you're Danny Ainge. So those opportunities, those players don't become available very often. But if anybody is positioned to get one, we can really see when it's going to happen. That's the point. Like the Deron Williams trade happened out of nowhere. Obviously, Carmelo in Denver, you sort of knew that was coming. But a lot of times you don't really see these situations developing. Maybe one key player gets hurt on a team you think is going to be a contender, and that renders them not a contender. And all of a sudden another player is available. There's so many different ways to go about it. You have to be lucky. Without question. But all you can do if you're Danny Ainge and the Celtics is put yourself in position to be the first call, to have the best package of assets. And for example, this last summer, the whole thing of Kevin Love, and when you're talking about not having a star, when the Celtics had Rondo, that was certainly plan A, to use Rondo the way you use Paul Pierce and have him be the first guy and bring in two more. And if Cleveland doesn't jump Boston and win the lottery, as you well know, Boston probably has a better... and a LeBron thing happens, before LeBron and the number one pick, when you go into that offseason with the Celtics finishing with the worst record than the Cavs did last year, the Celtics probably had positioned themselves to have the best possible offer for Kevin Love. And then everything changed. It was the draft lottery and LeBron happens. But that's all you can do. You got to be lucky and good. You put yourself in position and then hope things bounce right.
With all this said, though, Sean, it's kind of funny that you look at the standings and the Celtics are still, I think it's only, what, 3 games out of the last playoff spot in the East,
yeah.
Which maybe tells you all you need to know about the Eastern Conference this year and the depth therein. Are there any guys on this team right now that you think could be a building block for the championship run that might hopefully optimistically come 4 or 5 years down the road when this rebuilding plan comes to fruition? I mean, a guy like Jared Solinger I've been following ever since his college days. Could someone like that or a Marcus Smart or a Kelly Olynyk be an integral part of a successful team that makes deep playoff runs?
Those are the three, certainly. And you might put at this point, I'd put Marcus Smart first. I mean, Jared Solinger, what happened last year for the Celtics is fans got excited about what had happened in 2007, thinking that lightning could strike twice. And what people forgot was, in 2007, Al Jefferson, Delonte West, Ryan Gomes, all these, Gerald Green, these guys were 2 or 3 years in. Al Jefferson was 3 years into his NBA career. People had a much better idea. When you got to last summer, Kelly Olynyk had been a rookie. Jared Solinger had played a little over a year because of the injury. And they weren't, the Celtics, those young assets, and Marcus Smart hadn't been drafted yet, those assets aren't in that prime position to either build around or be those Al Jefferson-type chips to make the trade until 2015 or 2016. So I think those certainly are the three guys. I think that you could make, legitimate, as far as where Jared Solinger is versus Al Jefferson, they're different kind of players. But you could say through about 2 full seasons, they're pretty similar as to where they are. Kelly is, they're both having trouble, I think, consistency-wise, which young players do when you're 21, 22, is you don't know. But there are nights that Al Jefferson and they, in 2005 looked like an absolute beast, and Jared Solinger looks that way a lot of nights. Kelly Olynyk has had games where he has looked like a rookie who was brand new to the NBA, and he's had games where he's been a 20-10 guy and looked like someone you could build around. So that's part of Brad Stevens' job. Brad Stevens' job is to develop those guys while the earth keeps shifting underneath him to do what you're talking about, to get them ready to either be the building blocks or the trading blocks.
I know you got to call a game on television with Tommy Heinsohn recently, stepping in for one of our all-time favorites, Mike Gorman. What was that experience like? Did you get any Tommy points for that telecast?
It was really funny because, you know, it was 2001 when I came to the Celtics, and part of the recruiting pitch to get me to come was obviously that, you know, Max and I would sort of be in position to succeed Mike and Tommy whenever that happened, but that I would be, you know, I'd be the film. I had done TV in Minnesota. That's where I was coming from. I'd been between ABC and the Timberwolves. I'd been all TV all the time the previous 4 or 5 years, and, you know, college hockey stuff and whatever. So I just had assumed at that time Mike wasn't that far removed from being a fill-in. He'd get, like, the last playoff series on TNT. That might have happened a year or two, and he'd do some stuff for CBS and the NCAA tournament. So the idea that he would miss games, like, was not that far-fetched. There it is 14 years later, and that was the first time I got to finally fill in with Tommy. But it was, it was a bucket list thing. I mean, Tommy was a little under the weather that night, so it wasn't the full Tommy show that I'd kind of dreamed about, to the point where there was a bad call against the Celtics in the third quarter. Ball clearly went out of bounds off the Hawks, and they gave it back to Atlanta, and Tommy kind of went, ah. And I literally said, that's it? That's all I've been waiting my whole life to sit here with you. That's all I get, the one thing. And, you know, they put it on camera, and he kind of wound up and gave me the big, I'm perturbed. But it's been a, you know, it's funny because I don't get to watch those guys. I watch some of the replays some of the time, but Mike and I don't get to watch each other work. Obviously, we're working at the same time. But traveling with them, I've learned so much. Just traveling with, he doesn't travel anymore, but, you know, for 12, 13 years, to travel with Tommy Heinsohn. And if you are a student of the history, you know, I'm a student of the history of the game and certainly the Celtics because I work here. But the industry, when I was thinking about working with Tommy, and that we talked about, you know, sitting at dinner, is just running through some of the guys he's worked with. You know, with Brett, with Vern Lundquist, with Dick Stockton, that people forget that about Tommy, that in the 80s, when these vintage, iconic moments were happening, Tommy, more often than not, was the analyst, not to mention the first iconic sports TV commercial, you could argue, with the Miller, you know, Tastes Great, Less Filling, and Tommy was in on those, too. In the 70s. So it's to me, whenever I get a chance to touch any of the history, it's pretty cool. It was, you know, a few years ago during the finals, in 2010, I went to a Dodger game on the off night, and our engineer, Mike Nodo, you know, is a good friend of mine, and he does the Spanish radio. He brought me up to the press box and met Valenzuela, who does the games, and that was really cool. And I was heading back to my seat, and as I did, I noticed the Dodger TV booth was open. The door was open. So I know I shouldn't have done it, but come on. So I just kind of like snuck in the back door and listened to a half inning just to say I could, you know, just to say I had done it. And wow. Just to be that close to touching the history. So
awesome.
It was a pretty cool experience.
One quick NBA thing before we hit some other stuff. I want your take on a couple Eastern Conference teams. Atlanta, 13 wins in a row, 34-8 with a roster that probably, unless you're a hardcore fantasy basketball player or you play NBA 2K14 nonstop, you're not going to know a single person on that roster. On the other hand, though, Cleveland, sort of floating around 500, maybe turning the corner once again, but so much turmoil seemingly following them at every stop this season. What is the bigger surprise? Is it Atlanta 34-8 or is it Cleveland 5th in the Eastern Conference, and I think it's 22-20, their record?
I think they're both pretty big surprises. I mean, I'm as disappointed as anybody in Cleveland. I didn't think the Cavalier team was going to win 65 games. And I think, again, from a Celtics perspective, and I try to be anyone that's ever heard me work, which I realize a lot of you listening probably haven't. That's probably the strangest thing about my job and about having the Twitter audience or whatever. There's so many people who sort of know me now but actually don't know me for what I really do. But even trying to subtract myself from the Celtics thing, you got to step back and look at that 08 team. You know, the Lakers in 2004 had the super team, and they struggled. You know, Miami and the Super Friends, they didn't have a great start the first year. And I think this is more natural and normal for a bunch of players thrown together for the first time, especially with a new coach, than what the Celtics did in 08, starting 29-3 and winning a championship wire to wire with a double-digit scoring differential, by the way, for the entire season, which no team in the NBA that didn't have Jordan on it has done in the last 40 years. The 08 Celtics are the only ones to do that. So I think it's more that they were the exception than the rule of these super teams. I do think the Cavs will be fine. I'm a David Blatt fan, and I think it is eventually all going to work out. But the Hawks' lesson is one of, first of all, these are good, you know, I think the superstar curve, you know how it works. It falls behind. People don't necessarily recognize players for being star players without the name value. And Al Horford, let me tell you, I mean, if you don't know, call somebody. Al Horford, you can make a case, is the MVP of the Eastern Conference right now. Since he's gotten healthy 2 or 3 weeks into the season, he's been that good and that dominant. He's playing the Garnett role, as Garnett was at the Celtics with Atlanta. Teague is one of those guys, and we're going to see another one on the trip. I was talking to somebody about today, Ty Lawson in Denver. These are point guards, unfortunately, playing in the golden era now of point guards in the NBA, where you can be a damn good point guard, and you're not one of the top five, and you're certainly not a Russell Westbrook sexy player, but Jeff Teague is that, you know, is that good. And you've got a coach who's in his second year now. The guys have bought into what he wants to do, and given, I'd say, beating up on the weak East, but Atlanta went out west and had that unbelievable trip. So maybe instead of sitting around being surprised, we should all, include myself, pay more attention at the start of the year when we're making predictions about systems and players playing together rather than who has all the stars.
All right, let's hit a couple general sports media topics, because I know you pay close attention to what's going on in the industry.
We're going to your site first, primarily to see if our name is in it. That's what we do first. But, you know,
nah.
Here it is. The place to go to now, the clearinghouse that a lot of us are going to, like one of the first things in the morning, and yet a name created to disparage all of us, to seek out our mistakes. Instead of the 1,000 planes that we land every day perfectly, you seek out, putting us on notice, since when, I forget the year, putting us on notice that you'll be seeking out our every mistake. You know, Chris Rock says that he has a daughter. When he has a daughter, the one job as a father is to keep him off the pole. Our job is to stay off YouTube and to stay out of awful announcing. That's like our one job now.
Now, I think we're a bit more friendlier to the announcing industry than maybe the early days now, Sean.
It's
not always.
How are all my CBS guys doing? How are the grades coming in so far?
It's not, you know, they're evolving. It's not always a bad thing, though, to appear. I mean, you know, the podcast.
Hey, I'm kidding with you. This is the life we chose.
You know what I was amazed with, and you mentioned everyone kind of keeping an eye on things. It reminds me of what our good friend Richard Dijet, Sports Illustrated, said to me one time. That was, everyone reads everything, which was good advice because I was amazed. You know, bucket list for me, Marv Albert comes on the AA podcast.
Yep.
The first thing he tells me is what a fan he is of the website. You know, hashtag humble brag, whatever, but I was like, Marv Albert is paying attention to what us schmoes are doing on a daily basis. Like, makes you take a step back a little bit.
Well, again, I copyright what I said 10 minutes ago about those of us that hold microphones for a living, and obviously we look at ourselves closely. And it's a business. Listen, we don't have statistics to say, hey, this guy is better than this guy is better than this guy. It's all completely subjective, and we all think we're better than this guy and this guy and this guy. So that creates an environment where everybody not only wants to talk about themselves, but everybody's willing to talk about other people, and it can be a pretty – listen, I think it's funny because usually the younger generation – and I'm more in the play-by-play world now talking about this, but I and Eagle and I have talked about this for years, that generally speaking, the younger generation tend to be the more ambitious, backstabbing – whatever, but I think the business has changed a little bit. I think we have a good group of people our age. I guess we're not that, you know, those of us that are all, you know, we're all around 40, we're not that young anymore, but, you know, we're more collegial, I think, but this is a pretty cutthroat business. You're the generation above us, and it's hard to escape that. And you're writing every day about our industry and about us as personalities and talents, when, as you said, everybody reads it. That includes the people that do the hiring. And so it's in the business. I can't point to somebody else. I can't point down to, there's no announcerreference.com that says I hit 346 last year. You know, he hit 88% of his segues perfectly. And he called, you know, he called this play. He had a 99.6% pronunciation accuracy. That stuff doesn't exist. It's all subjective and personality. So that helps drive it. And
hopefully,
I wonder how many people, like fans, are really all into it. I don't know, but I know obviously we are.
Hopefully, this appearance at least lifts your podcast ELO rating up a few notches.
I'd like to think between, how many people do you know, by the way, who've done the AA podcast, been a regular on the BS Report, and done Jim Ross's podcast?
I think you're the only one. I think that might be, that's a little history.
Before she left ESPN, I think I did like the last Michelle Beagle podcast at ESPN. So this is, I think I found my niche.
The history maker, Sean Grandy. You mentioned your good friend Simmons, so I don't want you to put you on the spot completely, but tell me where he's going to be a year from now.
Well, you know, I wouldn't, if whatever I do know, obviously I'm not going to say, though I'm friends for a long time. I will say this. It does not look good for right now, the scenario that I certainly hope, like the two friends you love that you don't want to see divorce. I certainly hope this works out. I think ESPN's a better place for Bill Simmons. I think Bill Simmons is better being on ESPN rather than trying one of the things that is untapped. I think what has been built at Grantland is something extraordinary, an extraordinary collection of writers, the likes of which we haven't seen anybody try anything this ambitious. I would hate to see that get affected. And I think they belong together. I think there's a cooling off period needed, and I certainly think it can work. A lot of things, you know, Bristol is a constantly evolving, changing, you know, who's in certain offices making decisions seems to constantly change. But I'll say this, I'm a, you know, Bill Simmons, my friend for 15 years, but obviously I'm a Bill Simmons fan, and I'm a huge John Skipper fan as well, who oftentimes seems to be playing chess when a lot of these other guys are playing checkers when it comes to seeing the whole field. So my hope is that, although I'm not overly optimistic right now, my hope is that it works out and that they all stay together.
Another ESPN guy that we've kind of been following throughout the year is Chris Fowler, and more, this might speak to what we've just talked about with sort of the grading of announcers and, you know, how there's no real metric or statistics to evaluate performance, that it's a very subjective world in which we operate. Chris Fowler's moved from the studio to the broadcast, but with a lot of folks, you know, wanted Brent Musburger on those games. I didn't think he necessarily deserved to be demoted to SEC Network. I understand why ESPN did it, though. And I thought, listening to him, it felt like throughout the regular season that he sounded more like a studio guy trying to do play-by-play than a pure play-by-play guy. And that's not to take away from his excellent studio work, excellent at tennis. But really, it was kind of interesting that during the national championship game, during those playoffs, it finally felt like Fowler was owning that play-by-play role and stepping up a bit more energetic, a bit more lively with his calls. How difficult is that transition for an announcer to make from the studio to the broadcast booth and really settling into that play-by-play role?
Well, first of all, where do reps come from? And reps is what makes people better. Chris Fowler is an unbelievable talent. And I think he is a little different from a lot of the guys. You know, ESPN, a lot of the dynamic there is guys are in the studio. They become famous because of the four letters. And they gain great followings and people know who they are. But they're in Bristol all the time. And they want to get out. And play-by-play, for some of them, sometimes becomes like a hobby. Like, oh, that looks like fun. Plus, I can get out for the weekend. And that's not necessarily how you get the most skilled play-by-play guys who maybe have been doing it for 20 years and cut their teeth in the minor leagues and are more skilled and polished. And I think Chris was doing it, I'd done it to some degree, but it's so good. First of all, people wanted him in that role. They loved him in that role. They loved that show. That and Inside the NBA, the two most beloved studio shows. So there's sort of that natural, you know, you want to see people where you're comfortable. It's comfort food. Plus, Brent, you know, I'm sure there's people that don't like everybody. I guess Joe Buck gets trashed. Joe Buck, if you watch Joe Buck on Sunday, I mean, is there anybody who can really that has, can look at it objectively, say this isn't one of the greats.
You mentioned Joe Buck, and that's very interesting because when I started, when I was first doing this full time, Joe Buck was probably on the top three hated list of announcers. I mean, every Sunday, Joe Buck this, Joe Buck that. And I think it was maybe 2011, 2012. He called that World Series with the Cardinals. He joined Twitter, and it just seemed like he started showing more personality, was more engaging, more enthusiastic. And I've turned around on him, and I think this is surprising me. There's not maybe 10% of the Joe Buck hate that I used to see 4 years ago than I see now. And that's with, you know, exponentially more Twitter followers and opportunity for announcers to be trashed on Twitter because, as you and I both know, everyone hates everything on Twitter. But it's kind of funny that Joe Buck is maybe the one guy that I've seen, not just, you know, those of us that cover the sports media, but fans kind of turn around on someone.
I think you start with, there's the old premise that you begin with the idea, hey, do I want to have a beer with this guy? And Joe is so, you know, is so intelligent and is so talented. And I think there comes a time when you've done the things that he got to do so young and, you know, so early that there are times that, hey, listen, it's human nature, as you were asking earlier about doing these Celtic games, there's human nature that you can become bored with what for some people would be a huge thing, or some national game in a week. You know, when you're doing the World Series and the Super Bowl every year and you've done all these big events, I think there were times that you could make the case to, you know, an average fan that Joe was coming across a little bit, you know, above it all. The Jim McCarver thing, which is an entirely separate issue, McCarver, and I'll say this, so I will take the rap. This is not Matt saying this. I am saying it. Jim McCarver revolutionized the analyst position. He is, in my view, the best, he is the best to ever do it. Now, I recognize why, late in his career, particularly doing national games and you're doing it to a national audience and people feel like they're being talked down to or hardcore baseball fans, I get it. And there's an element that you'll appreciate this analogy more than anything because I've used it with Joe Buck before. There's the John Cena thing. You know, let's go Cena. Cena sucks. Is a beach ball that the crowd is throwing. If John Cena ever went away, WWE would be in huge trouble. And they will chant that, by the way, at Cena's Hall of Fame induction. They'll chant, let's go Cena, Cena sucks, because it's part of, you know, the audience participation. It's not really, you know, it could be hating the character or whatever, but I think that the Twitter thing certainly helps, and I'm not sure Joe Buck is ever going to be, isn't that one of the guys. But you know what? He's not one of the guys. He's extraordinarily talented, intelligent, whatever. He's not, you know, you can't change your game too much, so there's always going to be people that aren't going to like you from a personality standpoint, and I totally get that. But I think the more years he's there, people eventually kind of, you know, you come around to it. It's hard when somebody's new. And this happens with Fowler, too. There's people who love Brent. They were used to Brent doing it. It takes a while for when somebody new replaces somebody. Like when CBS, when Vern eventually retires, somebody familiar will probably just kind of bump up one spot. It's not as dramatic. But to talk to someone, for example, I replaced Kevin Harlan in Minnesota, who was extremely popular local announcer at the time, and I was 27 or 28 or whatever I was, and those were big shoes to fill. Howard David was arguably the best radio play-by-play guy in the NBA when I followed him. It takes a while, and eventually what happens is it's just like a character on a soap opera or a TV show. Eventually people are like, you know what? I like this guy. I kind of get a kick out of this guy, and I'm familiar with him now, and he's been in my living room for a couple of years. So I think that, listen, when Joe Buck eventually decides to retire, there'll be a huge special about everything he's done, and there'll be huge, you know, memes written on through Twitter and links and whatever. And that's just the way of it. I just think we have to realize that, you know, Twitter is the new. Here's the one thing I always say. You know, you ever see the bumper stickers? You know, how's my driving? Nobody ever calls that number to say, you know what? I saw your guy back out of a loading dock across two lanes of traffic, and it was just the most perfect thing I ever saw. Do that. You're not going to get that call. So Twitter is.
Someone listening is going to do that, Sean. You just wait. Someone listening, please do that. Call that number when you see one of those trucks make an outstanding park job, and tweet us and let us know about it.
And you know, Twitter's turning into our own. You know, you get sort of the anonymous tweets from the people that don't follow you, and then when you do, you know, the people that do follow you will kind of become your. I hate to, by the way, follower has got to go. That's just the her. It's like you're the king of Siam or something. You have these followers to follow. It's a terrible term. You know, like customers is really what they are. And these are people that I'm trying to serve with Celtics information or, you know, something that's funny or entertaining or whatever. But it's been a game. It's a game changer. Hopefully it has changed things and helped Joe, because it has changed. It's changed the game for everybody else.
Give me one or two people in the sports media whose work that you're fond of, who you'd like to see more of on a national stage.
Ooh, that's a good one. That's a good one. I think, I don't know, we all get sort of biased by our friends, and then they start to get it. Well, I had, when I saw Ian Eagle, who's been, you know, a friend for a long time, and I'm really happy with the work he's getting, and I gave him all kinds of grief when I had him on my show, because he's, you know, he's like Richard Deitch's guy. You don't need me to pump him up anymore, because, you know, every other week Richard's got something in there good about Ian. So I'm really happy for his success. Boy, that's a really good question. Because so many people, there's so many different moving parts, and you want to see people sort of have success. An example of a guy that I use, who I don't think will ever get the credit that he deserves, is Kenny Albert. And there are reasons for that. You know, because Kenny will, you can't come in with a much bigger shadow than Kenny did. But all he does is show up and call the games and do a great, you know, he does such a solid job. And I'm partial to the guys that can do hockey, because there aren't a ton of people that do hockey as well. I like the guys that can do the multiple sports. Sean McDonough, who could do the multiple sports. And that's where the real skill is to me, is be able to do hockey one night and then basketball the next night and be able to do baseball. And that's to me, is the true art of it. And Kenny's absolutely one of those guys. I'll give you a great example of someone I can't really call him a friend. I've only sort of talked a couple of times. But I've been happy to see the extraordinary reviews. This will fall under your heading of not getting good press or good attention, because he's gotten a ton of it. But Kevin Burkhardt, has come around at a time. This is the most interesting thing to me about Kevin Burkhardt, where everything is, because of the ESPN culture, which is not a bad thing, it's just the way it is, everything's about me. Look at me, look at me, look at me. And you realize that you can come along as an announcer now and just be the exact opposite. I call him, and as the biggest compliment as I can pay, I sat down with somebody who works at Fox yesterday when I was in LA, and I used the example of Alex Smith. You know, you can win a Super Bowl, you can win football games by handing the ball off and by completing on third and four. You don't have to be Brett Favre. And I said that, it was sort of a self-realization, because I have those. For looking at it, you always compare your own individual work to other people. And as probably more of a Brett Favre style, you know, I'm probably going to throw more touchdowns than Kevin Burkhardt. But you know what? There's mistakes you're going to make once in a while, that when you're going for the home run, or that isn't necessary. So to see someone who's not in this look at me and just calls a pleasant game, to see him have success and get attention and get good reviews for it, that's been rewarding too, because there's many different ways to call a game.
Interesting. All right, let's move. We've got about 15, 20 minutes left. Let's finish up with the main reason that we have you on here today, Sean. And that, of course, is to talk about the Royal Rumble. Now, I know, as you mentioned, being a guest on the Ross Report had to be a big highlight for you. I know you're close with JR. What is that relationship like, being a wrestling fan? Are there any moments that you have to pinch yourself, almost think, you know, hey, this guy's coming in, calling some action with us in the NBA, being on the podcast, things of that nature. What's that been like, that relationship with Jim Ross?
Well, it's funny. I'm not even sure if you may know this and you may not. This will be the fifth year, I think, coming up. Every year now, when the Celtics go to Oklahoma City, he does a quarter of the game with me. We've been doing it for, we met, it's a game, if you're a Celtics fan, if you listen this long, you probably are. There was a game in that new Big Three era that Ray Allen won in Charlotte. He won it with a buzzer beater. And it was after that game, I was out, and there was Jim Ross. WWE was coming in town. They were downtown, you know, at a hotel. And there was Jim Ross. And I've always had a hesitation about meeting people of whom I am a fan, because you don't want them to be a jerk. You'd rather have your own memory. I mean, these are people who are really good friends of mine. Mick Foley's a really good friend of mine. I remember having this, like, hesitation when I met CM Punk a few years ago. I had this very awkward moment in catering at the Garden, which, by the way, that is a podcast in and of itself. If you ever get the opportunity just to sit in catering, it might be the strangest dinner party you've ever been involved in your life. His reputation is not necessarily being the most friendly guy. So I'm like, what do I say? It was awkward. We're literally sitting there by ourselves. And finally, he had done Dill's podcast a couple months earlier. And I introduced myself, and he knew who I was. And I said, you were on Dill's podcast, and he's a great guy. Anyway, we became quick, fast friends, but you're nervous about that kind of thing. So I was like, I want to meet your boss. What if he's not a great guy? And it's just one of those things, and he was a fan of announcers, and would have been great if he got the University of Oklahoma job. That would have been a lot of fun. I think a lot more people would have listened to it. And it's been great for me to see this renaissance of Jim Ross, this mainstream renaissance where he's doing the stuff for Fox, and who knows who'll end up doing UFC, and he does the boxing, and the pay-per-view, the New Japan pay-per-view, which he brought so many people to. But to see how many people love his work, and to see it's on your site and everywhere, anytime anything happens now, within 10 seconds, somebody's got a Jim Ross call over it. So that's been, that's been an amazing thing to see. But he's been a great friend, and it's a blast going into OKC every year and doing that with him.
It's funny, Sean, more and more sports websites, I feel like, are covering WWE today. I mean, Sports Illustrated, USA Today, you look at all the Jim Ross calls that are everywhere. So in a way, it kind of seems like it's more mainstream today now that the curtain has been pulled back, that we know it's all entertainment, versus when it might have been more popular in the late 90s or, further back in the Hogan, Flair kind of late 80s where it was presented as a true sporting event. It's just kind of one of those weird idiosyncratic things that's happening right now in sports culture.
I'll give you a theory on that and see if you bounce this around and see if you buy into it. And I'm not, I've never been the biggest Hulk Hogan fan because I was a Bob Backlund kid, and, growing up in New York. So when Hulk Hogan came in and took the spot, when I was whatever I was, 12 years old, you become very unhappy and resent him the rest of your life. Although I had dinner, here's a name drop. I had dinner about 10 years ago with the Iron Sheik and had to sort of, it turned out to be, a great guy, and I had to tell him how he
looked. One-on-one dinner with the Iron Sheik?
Well, no, this is even better. There were a few other people there. I was sitting next to him. The other sports celebrity there, and you want to talk about the strangest combination ever? Fred Lynn.
So Fred Lynn and the Iron Sheik walk into a bar, basically.
Exactly. Fred Lynn and the Iron Sheik and Grandy walk into a bar. This is, obviously, from this point you've gleaned, I haven't had a normal life. I don't have the same normal everyday life that other people have, and this is my life, and it is what it is. But my theory on the mainstream element, and Robert Flores is a good friend of mine, and we've already talked about Beetle, I think the Hulk Hogan effect, think about the age that all these people are. They're probably a little bit younger than me, so mid-late 30s. This is the Hulk Hogan generation that was mainstream, WrestleMania 1, the early... They've grown up into becoming prominent media people. So all these people, now you have like Todd Grissom and Jonathan Coachman who've been able to... That was inconceivable 10 years ago, let alone 20, that you could cross the line. When I've been asked for years and years and years, could you ever do it? And I came from a time where once you do it, it's like Moonlight Graham in Field of Dreams. You can't, once you step across, that's it. You can't go back. But now people go back and forth. And I think it's a lot, I think it's the Hogan generation and the Vince McMahon WrestleMania generation of the kids that grew up with are now prominently, and this isn't just on-air people, by the way, this is network executives, Fox, ESPN, places like that grew up with it and are fans of it. And when Hulk Hogan or somebody goes to Bristol and goes through there, it's a big deal.
Yeah. I think it's that, and I think the other part is now that they are open, that this is just entertainment, that there's not that – I think you go through a period in your life, maybe when you're a teen, young adult kind of age, that you don't want to ever admit publicly that you're a fan of the stuff.
Oh, yeah. Oh, there's no doubt.
But then you kind of reach that, 30 and up age where you just don't care what anyone thinks. Like, yeah, shoot, I love this stuff. I'll watch it all the time. So I think you combine those two, and I think maybe that could explain some of it. So you mentioned growing up being a Backlund guy, Madison Square Garden. So you grew up as a WWF guy, not necessarily an NWA guy, say in the 80s?
However, I will tell you that, and I did, and I rebelled against the Hulk Hogan, the cartoonish product in the mid-80s, to the point where there is a picture of me. Maybe I'll even send it to you. I'm front row at the first SummerSlam, and I'm 16, 17 years old, whatever, and I'm wearing a National Wrestling Alliance hat. And that was my teenage protest against the Hulk Hogan cartoon generation.
You were a pretty big nerd growing up, weren't you, Sean?
What do you mean growing up? You make it seem like I grew up. I've got cool friends. But here's the thing. Think about all the people I just mentioned who are my friends. Guess what? We were all nerds growing up. And now we're either the cool kids of the world. So that's how it happens. Mm-hmm. You got to wait it out. People peak too early. And all the cool kids who were, when they were teenagers.
It's a wonderful life lesson for us, Sean.
See? Ride it out, kids. Ride it out. If you're listening, one day you're sitting at home, all the cool kids are somewhere doing something cool, and you've been listening to this podcast for the last 45 minutes. But you know what? It's going to pay off. One day.
Are you a fan of the network? Are you a subscriber? What are you searching out?
I'm a subscriber. I'm a P1, and the highlight of my year was meeting Stephanie McMahon at an event last year, and she actually got me to say, we're with around a couple other people, and she's talking about the network, and she got me to say $9.99 out loud, which I think I immediately fell in love when that happened. I don't think I was over it for weeks. I've like to see, you want to see more, you want to see it do better, you want to see the company do better. I have some concerns about deluging everybody with the Attitude Era stuff on the network when you have created a situation where the current product is going to fail by comparison because you can't do a lot of that stuff now. And I think that there's two sides to that coin. That's a double-edged sword to do that. But yeah, I'm a hardcore P1, so I had the network the first day.
What are you searching out? Are you going back to some of the old stuff? Like, what's your favorite era to watch things from? Are you going back to, the 80s and watching some of the early Starcades, Attitude Era, Monday Night Wars, maybe some more recent stuff?
The original shows, I love documentary. I love 30, I'm addicted to 30 for 30 and Monday Night War and sports. If I wasn't a play-by-play guy, probably documentary would be the second thing that I'd be into. So I absolutely love that stuff. You'll have to see the stuff from your childhood that you haven't seen. It's tough when so much stuff is on YouTube. Obviously, the quality is better on the network. But that's probably the first thing. I'd say during the NBA season, the answer is not much. Because, there's two NBAs. I have two lives. Once the season starts, it's just a cavalcade of flights and hotel rooms and games. And you try to keep up the best you can. And it's fun to watch the network. But it really is more of an off-season thing. But that's what I'm kind of, like Monday Night War, I've watched that somewhat religiously, whenever I have the opportunity. And pretty much anything with Paul Heyman on it.
It's funny, I think one of the big conversations happening today is you have a lot of these stars of yesteryear. The Rock comes back in main events WrestleMania. The Undertaker, Sting is, making his big comeback now. But you always have that fear, where are the guys that are there on a 365, 24/7 basis? And it's almost like looking at building an NBA team. You wouldn't build an entire team and expect it to succeed around aging veterans when you're not going to get the best night in, night out, or they may not be there night in, night out. So do you think the company, you mentioned, some of the network subscription struggles, or they maybe haven't hit their benchmarks yet. Do you think that the business and, it's kind of like sports media, ESPN is the business, WWE is the business. You think they need to go in a new direction with that?
I think they need to put more emphasis on the development. I think you've stumbled into an extraordinary analogy, which is with ESPN now. The last couple of years, people said, well, all these networks are starting, and FS1 is starting, and NBC Sports Network, and CBS Sports Network, and ESPN is losing all these people. And the sort of the company line, the general thought is, the company is so much bigger than any one person. It doesn't really matter. But when you lose so many people so quickly, then you have all of a sudden, you don't have all these familiar faces that you've been used to that's a big part of ESPN. It's like, wait a minute, I mean, how many times have you turned on SportsCenter in the last 6 months? You're like, wait, who's that guy? Who's that guy? I don't know who this is. And when you had that exodus, particularly on the female side of the ball, when you obviously Beto came back, but when you lost Dana Jacobson and you lost Rachel Nichols left, and you had all these people you're very comfortable with and familiar watching, and everybody kind of leaves within a short period of time, then you have to rebuild. And I think anyone that's watched WWE knows that there's some really good stuff going on with NXT. But there's sort of that lag time between those guys being ready and, you know, when you can, you don't want to have them come all at once. They did that with the Nexus thing a few years ago, and they had some success with it. But it's hard when it's in between. But I think hardcore fans have a lot of faith in the brand and the family and in the future.
Who are three of your favorite guys to watch today? I mentioned, you know, some of the up-and-comers in sports media. Now we'll flip that around. Who are your two or three maybe up-and-coming people in WWE that you like to watch?
Well, I think Seth Rollins is going to be a main event guy for a long time. I think you're going to enjoy this run for him. I'm not. I think it seems as if they're starting to back off the Roman Reigns plan. Hopefully they are, because I think that was going to be rejected had they stuck with the original plan of just sort of anointing him. You know, just because you want him to be the next guy doesn't mean it needs to be 2 weeks from now. Sami Zayn and NXT is really good. There's the guy Adrian Neville, who I saw on an indie show 4 or 5 years ago, who used to wrestle as Pac, who's very, very good. Ric Flair's daughter, if you haven't had a chance to see her yet, she's tremendous in NXT. So I think, I don't know, I was really all in on Bray Wyatt early in the year because it was something so different, and he was having great matches. And it's hard now. They tend to want to spread the wealth rather than take one guy and then just, you know, ride it. But he had a lot of momentum, and he kind of beat it out early in the year. But, you know, I think there's a lot of good stuff.
Royal Rumble this Sunday. You mentioned the Roman Reigns plan. That takes me back to last year's event. Daniel Bryan left out. Batista gets the victory. You know, everything then changes when that plan is basically rejected by fans. And that was when we had Jim Ross on the podcast last year, basically talking about one of those rare instances where I think it was the fan support more than anything that actually changed their approach and the plans of what was going to happen behind the scenes. You mentioned some of that, maybe not to that extreme, but maybe some of those feelings out there now. So I'll ask you this question, and we'll go out on this one. Two different avenues to approach this. First, who do you want to see win the Royal Rumble? Second, most importantly, who actually will win?
I think that it's starting to trend. I think fans want Daniel Bryan. And I think that's the way. I think that's probably the smartest and safest way to go at this point. I think that the idea, it seemed from afar and just the people I talked to, that the idea was to build Roman. You know, the Roman Reigns injury just happened at a bad time because you wanted that 6 months to really build him up into being the Superman guy. And he would eventually beat Lesnar. Now you don't know if Lesnar's going to be around, and you have to subtract him from the equation. I think fans would have rejected Roman Reigns being shoved down their throat and winning the Rumble and being the guy, to the point where my idea was have Reigns go heel. You know, have him win the title, have him beat Lesnar or beat whoever, and then join Stephanie and Triple H and have him have a heel run first as champion before, you know, it sort of makes him a bigger star before the eventual babyface run. I think fans are going to want to see Triple H and Sting, and WrestleMania is its own ticket. You have the opportunity to give them something special with Bryan and Seth Rollins. And I don't know if Reigns is in on that. I don't know where if Cena is in on that as a three-way. But you have a chance to have a pretty spectacular wrestling main event as long as, you know, as well as the attraction of Triple H and Sting. And Daniel Bryan sort of being the Northern California, Northwest, hometown guy. Maybe that's enough. But I tend to think it should be Bryan, and at this point, that's probably the way I'm leaning, that's the way they're going to go.
Interesting. I know you and I will both be watching on Sunday, and then when WrestleMania season does come around.
You get to watch. I have a much more competitive game on Sunday to deal with. I've got the Celtics going into Golden State,
ooh,
which I think will be, you know, that should be on paper. I mean, that's an extremely competitive, you know, match as well. So then, no, don't have any illusions. There's no way I will also have my iPad on
the I was going to say, are you going to have the iPad in front of you?
I would never. never, I don't know what you've heard, but that would absolutely never, I sent Deep the picture of her in the front row at WrestleMania while I was doing. They seem to enjoy scheduling Celtic games on Sunday WrestleMania night every year. So every year, like, my friends are in the front row, wherever it is, and I'm, you know, calling a Celtics game. But
how does Max react to that when he sees the iPad come out?
Max, Max generally will have his iPad out doing his own stuff during games anyway. But Max is more of a throwback to the Gordon Solie era, to whenever there's the slightest little trickle of blood and we have to stop a game, Max just loves to say, he's busted wide open. Just like, you know, like Gordon Solie used to say, so.
That is amazing. Maybe we can start the campaign, Sean, to get you and Max to call maybe one night of Raw, SmackDown, NXT, something like that. I think that's where we need to go with this.
Max would be great, whatever he did. Do you want to talk about underappreciated national talents? Like Max could be in the studio in Turner. He could do the ESPN stuff. He's a very one of a kind contemporary personality.
Well, another one-of-a-kind personality, the one and only Sean Grandy. Sean, this has been an excellent podcast. Thanks for joining us today. Follow him on Twitter, everyone. Celtics fan or not, WWE fan or not, at Sean Grandy, PBP, nerd out with the rest of us. Great tidbits on the Celtics, so much more. Sean, a pleasure. Enjoy the game in Portland. Enjoy the rest of the West Coast trip. And we'll have you back. You know, we'll do some WrestleMania predictions or something when the time comes later this year.
All right, my friend, keep up the work. I'm just like, you know, Marv may get there first in the morning, but I'm not far from that.
Thank you, Sean. Take care.
All right.